Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron alongside Cindy DeFerdinand.
Hi, everybody. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday to you. Well, folks, we have another fantastic guest on our program today.
Yes.
One of the things that people really need when they're being coached or just trying to get to a better place, they got to eat right and they got to sleep right. And, boy, we really want to talk about sleep and the role of sleep and how that applies to maybe some of the different types of coaches out there. That are coaching people that are having sleeping difficulties. So we can, let's learn a little bit about the role of sleep. What do you think, Cindy?
Well, I'll tell you what, I was just in a nutrition seminar for 2 days, and this was a hot topic with the doctor that spoke, as well as the herbologist specialist. It was just a big topic. You know, people are really struggling with sleep, too much to do, just a lot of things interfering with sleep. And of course, everybody knows that when you get a good night's sleep, you feel like $1 million in the morning. So I'm really happy to introduce David Mayan, who is the founder, CEO, and program director of Sleep Recovery Centers in Long Beach, California. And he's here today to talk to us a little bit about how you can restore sleep quality without medication, and as it relates specifically to the topic of recovery, and also for peak performance in business and executives, for high-level executives and people in business. And I'm sure it's going to be applicable to any of our listeners today, because I don't know of anybody who's not concerned with getting a quality night's sleep, right? So welcome, David. We're happy to have you on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Cindy.
So tell us a little bit about, well, I'm kind of curious how you got in this business. I'm really interested, you know, as a coach, and you know that we always ask people's story, that what led you to opening the sleep recovery centers, and in your path, a little bit of your background and what led you to this.
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. Well, in 2000, I had developed this rare seizure disorder called myoclonus, and I didn't know what it was at the time. I didn't even have a name for it. And it's what myoclonus is, these mild or brief tics or twitches that happen. Sometimes they'll happen during the day, but most of the time they happen at night when people are sleeping or trying to sleep. And mine happened to happen just as I was falling asleep. And they started out kind of mild, and then they started to build up to the point to where every time I try to fall asleep, it was like somebody was poking me with a stun gun.
And where were the twitches? In your face? In your face?
No, they would would actually migrate. Myoclonus will migrate to different parts of the body. Sometimes it would be an arm. Sometimes it would be a leg. Yeah. And I was down about 2-3 hours a night. And the more sleep deprived I got, the worse they got.
Oh, you're kidding.
And so it was a real problem, real, real problem. And then
complicated name, right? Complicated name.
Myoclonus, yeah. You can go a lot of different ways with that particular disorder, for sure. But some of my friends were concerned, and one friend, his name is Eddie Cordy, said that I should go see Margaret. And I said, well, who's Margaret? And he said, in 1985, I had really bad cluster migraine headaches, and they were very debilitating for him. And he would be stuck in a dark room with a vomit bucket for days. And
that's awful.
And so he went to see her in 1985, and he did 20 sessions of something called neurofeedback with her. And he told me that he hadn't had a migraine in 15 years, thanks to her. Wow. So he said, you know, I don't know if she specializes in insomnia, but why don't you call her? So I called her. And Margaret, her last name was Ayers, and she was one of the inventors of this technology called neurofeedback. There were two men and one woman. And just as a little sidebar, back in the mid to late 60s, the NASA space program was stalled. They were having difficulty with the astronauts having seizures in the fuselage of the rockets because of rocket fuel fumes coming into the fuselage. And for some reason, they couldn't stop the fumes from coming in. So they brought in Margaret and two other men, and they did a really early work for neurofeedback on the astronauts and got them to literally stop seizing. And that's how we got to the moon. So she had this really cool, long storied history about neurofeedback. So anyway, I called her and told her what my symptoms were, and she was the first person to say, yeah, you have myoclonus. And then she asked me if any of my parents had epilepsy, and I told her that my dad had petite mal seizures, and she went, bingo, there it is. You inherited it, a milder form of that from your father. So I asked her, can you help me? And at this point, I was like at the end of my rope, and she said, oh, sure. She was very cavalier and very kind, and said, yeah, it'll take about 20 sessions, but you'll be fine. And I just began to weep uncontrollably because it was the first hope I had ever heard from anybody. And, you know, I had been to psychologists and psychiatrists, all different litanies of medications. I went to a $4,000 Siberian shaman. I mean, just desperate for
exhausting yourself, right? Physically and financially, right? It's so nice when you get to the solution, right? When you find it, right? It's such an awesome feeling.
And so 12 sessions later, my sleep returned. Didn't even take 20. Mm. I finished the 20 because she said, your brain needs reinforcement. But I was hooked. And I asked her, I said, Margaret, how many people in your field specialize in insomnia? And she went, oh, none. And I said, why? And she was very blunt. She was just very, very direct. She said, most of the people in the field of neurofeedback are psychotherapists, and they're really lazy. And they don't want to deal with grumpy, difficult people. So they'll take the ADD kids or, you know, the other stuff that that is easier to deal with. So that stuck in my head. And, you know, at that time, I was in a different type of business. But after she finished, I went out and bought my own system, almost like a toy, and to play with it. So I started working on my own brain and got pretty good at it. And then I started working on friends and family, and they started getting better. And then they were sending people who wanted me to pay me to do it. So that's pretty much how it started.
So just tell me, I know we're talking about the neuro feedback as it relates to sleep recovery and peak performance. What other things, I mean, obviously, just like broad base, if somebody isn't familiar with neurofeedback, what broad base situations can it help with or correct?
Well, what I'd like to do is shift gears a little bit and talk about the source point of what neurofeedback does. That's the best place to start. And the reason for that, Cindy, is that our society in America, we are very disease and disorder based. So people want to go to what's wrong with them first. They want to go, no, okay, I want to know if this works on anxiety, and I want to know if it works on Lyme disease or ADD. And it does, but there's reasons for that. And my practice is what's called diagnostically agnostic, meaning that we're not concerned so much about what you have or what the doctor labeled you as having. Our job is to provide rapid relief that is indelible, that's going to last a long time. And if we focus so much on the problem and where it came from, then we're losing traction and we're losing touch on that goal of getting results as quickly as possible. So here's kind of how it works. There's a whole symphony of electrical activity inside the human brain that's going on all day, all night, every day. And it's from second trimester in our mother's womb all the way up until about 4 hours after we pass and stop breathing. There's still electrical charge going on in there. And this electrical flow is responsible for everything we do, how well we pay attention, how relaxed we are, how much anxiety we have, how well we sleep, how well we stay clean and sober, how well we pay attention, you know, in various environments as far as business meetings or negotiations. And through heredity and sometimes unresolved trauma, that electrical activity can get out of balance. So it's called instabilities. And the brain is very self-intelligent, and the brain knows that those instabilities are there. It also knows they're not supposed to be there. So it's always looking for outside ways and means to self-correct those instabilities. Now, it's doing this independent of the conscious person knowing. The conscious person is just
taking along
for the ride. And I'll give you a good example. You'll have a person who has a lot of anxiety, and they go out and socialize with their friends, and they go out and have dinner, and they have a couple glasses of wine. Now, the alcohol in that wine pushes a brainwave called low alpha, and low alpha is the feel-good, super relaxed, almost euphoric brainwave. And so in 20 minutes, that anxiety drops 80%. Now, mm-hmm. the person's not thinking this, but their brain says, aha, eureka, I found the solution to the instability. So the greater the degree of instability at a later date, the more there is a compulsion to repeat that behavior again to get that same effect. And mm-hmm. this may be the source point of where problem drinking starts.
Wow, that's
interesting. So, yeah, and so some brains will gravitate towards that. Some brains will gravitate towards medical marijuana. Benzodiazepines like Xanax and Klonopin are used massively. And so the brain, again, being self-intelligent, looks at what it's being thrown at, what's being thrown at it. And it's saying, look, dummy, this is a bioelectrical instability. This is not a neurochemical problem. Stop throwing medications at me. And it will complain, and it will complain in the form of side effects. So when people get strung out on benzos or medical marijuana, the brain will complain, you know, by making people kind of dumb. And, benzodiazepines like Xanax, they inhibit the brain's ability to learn anything new. So people are kind of in a perpetual stupor on that stuff. So what neurofeedback does is it circumvents that entire process. So it's giving the brain detailed, instantaneous feedback on how it's just fired or misfired, to be specific, and how to go about correcting it. And it does so non-invasively. So there's no shock treatment or charge that goes into the brain at any time. And it works real fast, really, really fast.
That's really interesting. How, can you explain how maybe you talked about unresolved trauma, if you break apart the heredity or the unresolved trauma causing these mm-hmm. electrical instabilities, how would trauma, and of course there's trauma, it can be, lots of different ways trauma can affect us, mm-hmm. but how, I mean, if it was like an injury or a psychological injury or physical injury, how does that actually create the instability, the electrical instability? I always use this word like trauma. It's almost like it imprints on you, and it's trapped energetically in your body. And some right. There's lots of ways to work to release that. But can you maybe explain like how that actually affects your brain's electrical system?
Oh, sure.
A traumatic event. Good. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Very, very good question. So I'm going to get a little controversial here because there are things.
We love controversy. We love controversy on this show. Yeah.
It's also translated to just somebody just coming out and telling the truth. So we have two brains in one. We have an outer brain, which is called the neocortex, and it's about an inch and a half thick. And that's kind of the human brain 2.0. And that is the latest addition in our evolutionary process of brain development. And that's responsible for things like higher thinking, mathematics, music, philosophy, art, literature, and language. And the inner brain, called the limbic system, is like the brain 1.0. And that's the brain that we used as a species before we developed all these other attributes, particularly language. You know, we spent a lot of time evolving without the use of human language. And there's a part of that limbic brain called the amygdala. And it's about the size of a walnut. And it's kind of like in the more towards the front of the brain. And this is responsible for fight or flight, fear response, sexual desire, how well we are able to surrender to intimacy, how safe we feel in the world. And what happens is that when somebody has a trauma, there's a design flaw in the brain.
When somebody has trauma...
There's kind of a design flaw in the brain. So when that trauma hits, if it hits very quickly, it doesn't get processed through the neocortex or the outer layer, and it gets stuck in the inner brain in the amygdala in the form of what's called high alpha. And you can actually see it spike on a screen when you have people hooked up. And so the brain, again, knows that instability is there, and it also knows it's not supposed to be there, so it's constantly trying to purge it out. But just like when somebody slips a disc in their lower back, the other design flaw is for the muscles around the slip disc to spasm around it to try to protect it from further harm.
Right, right.
And so it causes more pain than what's actually there. And the outer layer of the brain does the same thing. It's called hypervigilance. You may have heard that term before. Mm-hmm. And so when that deep brain is in that state of distress, the outer brain goes into this state of high anxiety, where its job now is no longer to live life peacefully and calmly. Its job is to brace itself for the next assault. It doesn't know where it's coming or what corner it's coming around, but it knows it's coming. So people live in this perpetual state of fear, and it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And the problem and the controversy is that most of the interventions for trauma are psychology-based. And psychology is based, unfortunately, on language exclusively. So they're trying to treat part of the brain with language-based therapy that does not understand human language, doesn't understand it. And so what they'll get, what the client or the patient will get, is they'll get these short-term catharsis. And well, so they'll have this huge release, and then it's overblown as a potential, you know, miraculous recovery from your trauma.
And it's not over. I had a quick question, if I could just ask. You had mentioned when the trauma hits or happens quickly, if it happens quickly, that there is this design flaw in the brain. Can you explain what you mean by that? And then it gets stuck in the inner portion of your brain. But what did you mean by the design flaw? Does that mean there's a genetic predisposition?
No, it's more evolutionary. No, evolutionary.
Okay.
Than anything. So a good example is men and women are wired differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that one.
Men are wired to be, and I'm talking about the whole arc of history of our species. Men are wired to be warriors and hunters. So their brains are wired to be able to handle that kind of stuff. You know, a saber-toothed tiger comes at them, you know, and it's the thrill of the hunt. And women historically have been gatherers. And it doesn't make them less than. In fact, they were more important to tribal life than the hunters. But their brains are not wired for that. And so it's trauma is harder on a female brain than it is on a male brain.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah. And so, and again, women, in my humble opinion, are smarter. They have a higher threshold for pain because of childbirth. And they're pretty much, you know, they're pretty much smarter than men across the board. As far as I'm concerned, the dumbest woman is 10 times smarter than the smartest guy. And when
I better not make a comment or that could be a whole show.
When I accepted that reality, my life went a lot easier.
It got a lot easier, smoother, right?
Yeah.
I surrender, uncle.
So in a warrior's brain, when there's a trauma, that outer cortical layer does its job and it processes that trauma before it gets stuck in the inner brain. With other people or with women especially, the design flaw is that it bypasses that filtration process of the outer brain and gets lodged directly in the inner brain right away.
Now, how do we know that this happens to women and not to men? I mean, like, you know, from a scientific basis.
It does happen to men. But it takes more trauma, It takes more repetitive trauma. And, you know, Iraqi and Afghani war veterans are a classic example. These guys were put in a state of hypervigilance before they even had trauma from asymmetrical warfare. You know, the U.S. military is designed and engineered for full frontal assault, you know, like charge, you know, charge. And when they went into Iraq and Afghanistan, that wasn't that kind of war. You know, they were waiting around just for the next IED bomb to go off or mm-hmm. for the next sniper to pick them off. So they had the same type of trauma. It's just manifested differently, and it was more repetitive. So the problem is this high alpha amplitude that's stuck in the brain. And we can hook somebody up to a neurofeedback system. We have a separate protocol for trauma called alpha theta. And you can hook somebody up and have them close their eyes, and you can actually see that high alpha spiking on the screen, on the computer screen.
So the
modality for alpha theta doesn't use language. What it does is it uses two approaches to allow the brain to relax and surrender. And then once it's able to do that, it can start purging that high alpha. And the results get a lot better. They get a lot better. And I'll give you a good example. I was doing some charity work for an outfit called Pathways to Independence. You may have heard of them. And what they do is they take women 18 to 30, and all of them, their requirement is they all had a history of childhood sexual assault. And some of these poor girls were, like, passed around to four or five men before they were 8 or 9 years old. So we're talking major trauma and no sleep. They weren't sleeping at all. And they had 50 psychologists that were trying to stabilize these girls' sleep, and all of them failed, all of them. And so they sent me four girls, and I did both the stabilization protocol for the outer brain and the alpha theta protocol for the inner brain. And within 6 weeks, they were all sleeping 8 to 10 hours a night.
Wow, that's amazing.
And the founder, the outgoing founder, his name is Dave Bishop, he calls me one day, and one of the girls' name was Megan, and he says to me, and he's very excited, and he says, "What did you do to Megan?" And I'm like, "Oh no, it's over."
Right. She's had enough. Right.
And I said, "That's great." What do you mean? I'm thinking she like went off the deep end, right? And he said, "No, she's in my office and she's beaming with this huge smile on her face. What did you do to her? She never beams, because this is the kid. She wouldn't even look at people." So we know that it works. And it's very efficient. It's very, very efficient.
Okay. As it relates to the field of recovery and also peak performance, now I got a better idea of how it all works, and our audience will as well. I had one question before we get into how it affects recovery and peak performance in business. What you've seen is... you know, I'm sure there's some, you know, storytelling, you know, coaching is, you know, really letting somebody empty out and asking questions. Is there a component of that in your practice, or is it really just letting the brainwaves tell you the story? The electrical current, I guess, is a better way to say it.
Well, no. Story is interesting because story is the only part of our human existence that bridges both the existential or the deep brain as well as the conscious brain. You know, we've been telling each other stories and we've been communicating that way for thousands and thousands of years. So what I do is very different. Most people will go into a neurofeedback clinic and it's very dry and sterile, and they're given some forms to fill out, and then they basically sit down and there's no chit-chat at all. And they're hooked up, and they've done their session, and then they leave. And a lot of times, they're in these little cubicles, you know, where it's almost like a cattle call in and out.
Right.
And I don't do that. When people come in, they don't wait any more than 5 minutes. You know, there's no this 45 minutes and waiting in the doctor's office, waiting to see the professional. You know, nobody waits more than 5 minutes. And I sit them down, and I ask them a few basic questions, and then I let them tell their story, and I shut up. I close my mouth and I let them finish. Now, it could take 10 minutes, it could take 15 minutes, but it doesn't matter. And once they're done, then that therapeutic value is solidified, and the trust and credibility is there, and they feel like they've been heard. And yeah, I get so much important. Better results by doing that, you know, and that really factors into recovery too, because a lot of the people that came in the last couple of years were adolescents that had been through rehab 5, 6, 7, 12 times. And, you know, the adage or the culture in recovery is, they just weren't willing. They just didn't have enough willingness, or they weren't open-minded enough. And I thought, I don't really buy that. So what I did is I went to this club, and a local adolescent inpatient treatment would bust, you know, 10 or 20 of these kids in. So I started talking to them before and after the meetings, and I asked them questions, and it was almost like an informal survey study. I said, when you're in rehab, where's your level of anxiety? 10 being full on panic, 1 being none. They said, it's about a 3 or a 4. And how's your sleep quality? And they say, it's about the same. And then I say, and they go, well, I don't have any responsibility in there. I'm told what to do, when to go to the bathroom, when to go to a meeting, when to eat, when to wake up. And then I said, okay, now I want you to remember when you got out of rehab after 48 hours. Now give me the number for the anxiety and panic. Mm-hmm. And they went, it goes off the charts. And then I say, what about your sleep quality? And they go, what sleep quality? So in a very short period of time, that electrical instabilities in the brain go off running. And their brains only know one way to put that fire out, and that's to drink or use again. So it's not an issue of unwillingness. So what I did is I took 4 of them, and they were about to get out. And I said, have your moms call me. So the mothers called me, and I said, look, what we want to do is we want to do a 4-session rapid recovery trial. So as soon as they get out, the day they get out, I want you to bring them for 4 sessions in 4 days, and then we'll evaluate them. And the mothers were like, we're on. So they brought
them. They'll try anything, right?
We did four sessions in 4 days, and their anxiety went from a 9 to a 2 or a 3 in 4 days. And the parents are like, it was very obvious to the parents that it was helping their kids. So they signed up for the whole program. So we did the full 20. And I think it was about 11 kids. And 10 of the 11 are still sober. And it's been 2 years.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's been 2 years. And so, it's not to say that they didn't need meetings or recovery.
Other
or
stuff. Deaths. Right, right. Absolutely.
They did, but it allowed their brain to be able to stabilize enough to absorb recovery, to be able to hear what people are sharing at meetings.
Yeah, and actually start building their life, you know what I mean, where the coaching comes in. Sometimes they're not ready initially when they're first sober. So after you developed that program, have you worked more and more with people in recovery, and how do you relate the key benefits of that? In terms of what you do for?
Good question. And just for a note of correction, I didn't develop the software. The software was developed by a husband and wife team out of Vancouver. But I'm the first one to brand it for sleep for the entire country. So
good.
So when it comes to people in treatment or people out of treatment in recovery, I've learned a lot, and watching them and talking to them, I've learned even more. You know, the 12 steps are wonderful, but they are limited in their scope and application. And there are things that it works really good, that they work really good on, and there are things that don't work really good on. And more, I get people with 10 years, 20 years. I had a guy with 32 years who still had horrible anxiety and horrible sleep. He had gone through the program, worked the steps multiple times. He was sponsoring people. He was doing everything he needed to do. But that anxiety and sleep was still a problem. Now it's no longer a problem because he finished the program.
Terrific.
Yeah. So, you know, if people are in recovery, you know, we can kind of overdo the accept the things we cannot change without really exploring the ways and means to actually change it. And the women, the poor women in recovery, the anxiety is so bad. It is so bad. I mean, it's bad for the men too, but for whatever reason, the women are really struggling with anxiety, and they don't sleep, and they're at each other's throats. You know, they're sharing in meetings, you know, nice and fellowship and whatnot, and then the meeting ends, and they are just at each other's throats, and this can help. This can really, really help.
So, so that it actually can calm the anxiety as well as help sleep. Anybody knows if you sleep better, you're feeling calmer. I mean, like, that's
well,
kind
no,
of a given,
not,
right?
It's not necessarily
two
true,
separate issues. Then
they're two separate in brainwave instabilities.
Oh,
so
okay.
Kind of here's how it works. Because I specialize in insomnia for basically the normie population, people tend to think that's the only thing that works for. And I can tell them, no, it works for a bunch of different other stuff. And they go, oh, okay, it's just, it works for sleep. And I go, no. So we hook up two sensors to the scalp. They're like very sensitive microphones. And they listen in to all this electrical activity that's going on inside the brain. And that goes into software. And the software scans the brain 6 to 8 times per second and looks for where these instabilities are firing in a continuum. And some of them are connected to anxiety. Some are connected with panic attacks, some with sleep, some with attention, some with emotional immaturity, sports performance, business acumen, articulation, word finding. And so it's looking not just for the instabilities for sleep or anxiety, but it's looking for any and all instabilities all at the same time. And so it's teaching the brain to self-correct. So there's a whole host of other additional benefits that come
Wonderful.
In addition to sleep and anxiety. So I can take a newcomer who has had a history of being infantile in their level of maturity and turn them into a pretty mature kid in a month.
That's amazing.
You know,
that's like big stuff.
Yeah, and it's not widespread in recovery because A, insurance doesn't cover the cost. So the owners of the inpatient treatment who are making money hand over fist, who could afford to give this away, either don't do it because they can't make any money off of it, or they buy the cheapest system they can get their hands on, and then they hire somebody and pay them $12 an hour to do it.
Right, right.
And the person
that may not be experienced.
Well, exactly.
Mm-hmm,
At $12 an hour, just don't really, they don't really care.
Right. Well, it's a business, so, and if it's not covered, they're, you know, it's coming out of their P&L. So,
But that, as far as I'm concerned, that's just no excuse. I mean, when you're
I'm not saying it's an excuse. It's just the business, you know,
The
world
know,
of business.
The average,
you know?
The average cost for a 30-day stay in inpatient rehab is $68,000.
Yeah, also.
They could afford to do it right, and they could afford to give it away for the newcomer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just kind of go off on a little sidebar here. Back when they were doing the forming the Constitution, there was a corporate law, and it was called the Commons Law. And every year there was an overseer or an ombudsman, and they would go to a corporation and they would investigate them. And if that corporation, if their primary mode of business was for the benefit of the commons or the common good primarily, and their secondary motivation was for profit, they were allowed to stay in business. But if they were all profit and no help to the community, they had their corporate charter pulled and they had to start all over.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I run my practice and my clinics under that modality. You know, I do pro bono work for people who can't afford it. I did pro bono work for the girls from Pathways to Independence. And, you know, it's really about giving back. And there's nothing wrong with making money or a lot of money, but the primary purpose needs to serve.
Exactly. And a lot of businesses are set like that, but not all. That's definitely another show, right? For sure.
So
let's talk a little bit about how this relates to peak performance and maybe specifically in somebody's work performance, business life, executive life. How could this help? I mean, in terms of getting you, you know, maybe you've had traumatic events, maybe there's just some stuff going on that you're not even aware of, but you know you have anxiety, you're not sleeping well, you're under high pressure, you know, you got that gun to your head, you know. How would this support that?
Good question. Very good question. And I think the best place to start with that would be to look at the brain and the central nervous system of the alpha male or alpha female. Most people that are in business, that are successful and that are executives kind of fit that personality criteria. Not always, but most of the time they do. And so their brains by heredity, meaning they inherited it from their parents, runs naturally overactive. They're go-getters. They'll work, you know, 80 hours a week. They'll, you know, push the envelope because they want to excel. And that's great. That's great. But from a brain and central nervous system point of view and from a physiological point of view, it is not sustainable. And they will go without sleep like it's a badge of honor.
Yes, you know? I remember.
I mean, they'll be at the Equinox working out, and they'll tell the CEO before them, "Yeah, man, I'm running 4 hours of sleep.
I know. Badass." I've heard it so many times in business, I can't even tell you.
You know,
like it's a healthy thing. Yeah.
Oh, sure. And they go through their careers. They work 20, 25 years. You know, they achieve all the success they wanted. And by the time they're done, they're a wreck.
You know, that's not funny. That's not funny, but, you know.
But you got to find the comedy and the tragedy, Cindy. I mean, this is epidemic for people that are successful.
It's huge. It's very pervasive.
So my job is to tell them, first off, this is not going to make you any less creative or motivated or successful. What it's going to do is it's going to create a sustainable pace for you. And here's what I mean by that. One of the very common main effects or benefits that come from this particular type of neurofeedback is that not only does it lower stress and anxiety, but it raises the brain and central nervous system's ability or threshold for resiliency to stress. And so we have a way to be able to do, it's called a baseline scan. And it doesn't diagnose people, but it gives us some indicators on what's going on inside the brain. And we do one before and after each session. So it gives us some signposts to look at. And one of the things it looks for is how well the brain is using its energy resources up and down its own frequency spectrum. And, you know, our brains go from 0 hertz to 30 hertz. So it's kind of like an FM radio dial that goes 88.1 to 107.9. And each radio station has a particular task. And so the brain needs to dial into those to be able to get things done. And when people are real go-getters in alpha personalities, they get stuck in the higher frequencies. And their brain is habituated in those higher frequencies. And so when it's time to start to wind down and go to bed, their head just races. Like you know, they're stuck in fifth gear and the accelerator's all down. And they're like, I don't understand. Why can't I downshift? Their brain is habituated to be in that overactive state. And so the neurofeedback will teach their brain how to fluidly move up and down that frequency spectrum. When they need to be on, they can be on. When they need to relax and be
intimate with their partner, they can switch the channel.
With their partner, they can do that. If they need to sit down and play with their kids without the compulsion to get up and check their phone, they can do that too. So then they get the best of both worlds.
Right.
And when their energy resources are bogged down, it's kind of like we used to use hard drives that needed to be defragged. And so on a computer hard drive, when it's overused, the files get scattered all over the place. And the stylus or the arm of the hard drive has to work 3 times harder to get half as much done. And when we defragged the computer, it indexed all the files and made them organized so the hard drive could work, could get 3 times more done with half the effort. And this is exactly the same for the executive people. So we're going to be able to tune up your brain where you'll get 3 times more done with half the effort, half the stress, better resiliency towards that stress. So at the end of the day, you're not completely and utterly exhausted.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's got to be really encouraging to the people you work with, right? Because that's the ultimate goal of a high drive person, is to get more done and to do it in a calmer manner.
Well, the goal is to be able to get to the finish line intact. You know, where the main term here is sustainability. Nobody right. wants to work like mad for 20 years and develop all this success and be on a breathing tube, or
no.
to have heart problems, or to have, immune issues because you didn't sleep for 20 years.
Right.
You know, the goal is to achieve that sustainability.
And I think a lot of professionals or business people, executives, they really don't realize the wear and tear of being in high drive, or that lack of sleep, how important sleep is to your entire system. You know what I mean? It's
oh,
so
no.
critical. So
no,
critical.
They even have cultural myths and slogans or cliches that they use, like sleep is the enemy. And they're like, yeah, sleep is the enemy. You know?
Oh my God.
And or sleep is overrated. And I hear them at the gym. You know, I hear them at the gym all the time. You know, and they
the
have
sleep
no
is
idea.
Overrated. Well, because if they sleep, it's downtime. You know, you're not getting as much done. So there's so much to do. Why sleep? Right? Why sleep?
Well, you're not going to get anything done if you come down with fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue syndrome.
Exactly.
You know,
balance.
You're not going to get it.
Is the key.
Yeah, you're not going to get anything done if you have a major heart attack.
That's right. And then not taking care of yourself piece, you know, that doing, I used to call it when I was in the corporate world, one dimensional, that, you know, people that are completely one dimensional and they only right. operate on one or two channels. It's very unhealthy for your whole system. So I'm really glad to understand your work better and to see the good things that it can do for people and understand that a little bit better, as well as our audience. Now, beyond recovery, beyond the workplace, do you get a lot of people, like business people, who really are getting the notion that things are going wrong physically and this may be the solution? I mean, at what point does somebody say, or do they just have to hear about you or hear something? What's the point at which you get a person willing? You know, I know in the world of coaching, you know, it's all about, you know, people show up because they're ready to make changes, and which is very, very rewarding. In my clinical nutrition practice, that's not always the case. You know, people may want to get well, and they may want to make changes, but they often don't do the work, you know? So, how do you find
right.
that working? I mean, I'm sure that do people come willing? Do they have to be educated? What's the process of really getting people to the door and carrying through with the 20 sessions and believing that there's going to be a good outcome for them?
Yeah, well, that's a really poignant point. And you know, first off, the cool thing is that they don't have to do anything but sit there and listen to music. So they're software in the brain interfaces, and the exchange of data between the software and the brain is happening 6 to 8 times per second. So they don't have to focus or concentrate on any of it. The brain's doing all the work. And
so it's kind of downtime, right?
Well, but for corporate executives, you know, they'll be on their phone and it still works, even if they're on their phone.
Well,
you know,
that's great.
But, you know, every client population has a different personality set. You know, when people don't sleep, they get to a particular point where they'll do anything and they'll pay anything to be able to fix it.
Okay,
when people
so
have anxiety,
they are motivated. Yeah, they're motivated.
Yeah, when people have anxiety and a lot of anxiety, they get addicted to it, especially women. And they'll have this anxiety, and in order to justify the anxiety, they will build drama stories around that anxiety, and that becomes their life. And I've seen this time and time again where I'll do 2 or 3 or 4 sessions on a woman with a lot of anxiety, and she will disappear like a mirage in the way to Vegas. Gone. And it's because the feeling comfortable is very uncomfortable in the beginning. And if their life and their personality is built around that anxiety and the drama that's built around that, it's real hard for them to let it go. And I'll give you an example. There was one woman who disappeared, and it took me a week to track her down. And I finally got her on the phone, and I said, "Why did you stop coming?" And she said, "Oh, no, I can't do it anymore." I said, "Why?" She says, "It makes me too calm."
Oh, wow. Yeah. She liked being ramped up.
Right. Mm-hmm, and when it comes to peak performance and executives and corporate types, if you tell them, "Look, we're going to reduce your anxiety and improve your sleep," they also disappear. They're just not motivated to do it. So you kind of got to do an end run around, you know. And you, what you do, you say, "Look," and the defrag metaphor is really good for them, because they want to be able to get 3 times more done in half the effort.
Absolutely.
So if you
that
if
would
you
make sense, right?
That, yeah, if you approach it from that point of view, is, "Look, I'm going to turn you into a more of an efficient animal than you already are." Then they're like, "Okay, let's go."
Yeah. They'll do anything, you know, right?
Right. You know, if you want to be a better snowboarder, or you want to have better times in as a triathlete as well as an executive, we can do that. Then they're first in line.
Exactly.
You know, but if you tell them they need to improve their sleep, they're going, "No, I'm doing fine in 4 hours." You have no idea.
Yeah. You got to come at it from a different angle, right? We're almost out of time. Bruce, are you there? I know we had some difficulty. He had to drop off. Are you there, Bruce?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, I didn't know you were there. You got to speak up. Do you have any last minute thoughts for... He's going to tease me later about taking over again, the questions.
No, it's really, really interesting. I was a supervisor of a neurofeedback lab. I got my training with Gene Peniston, some of the other folks here in the University of North Texas. So I did the traditional alpha theta brainwave training for addiction. And
right.
Back in the day. So yeah, there's definitely that neuroelectrical, you know, relationship there. And I did the procedure with about 80 female trauma survivors in a women's federal penitentiary, but that again's another show. But it would be really interesting when we go through the scripts and to see things and how going through this type of work really changes the effect of medication and those things. And I'd liked our earlier discussion about the role of medication, how the brain doesn't necessarily receive that in a welcoming way, if it is a more organic issue that we're dealing with.
So. Bruce, yeah. was it the alpha theta protocol that you did on the inmates?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what we use for trauma at our practice.
And what would happen, and what would happen is we'd do these scripts, and these scripts would kind of, you know, get to kind of a hypnagogic state. I've been trained in clinical hypnosis and all those other things. I'm a licensed therapist and all that. And after a certain point, it's almost like the unresolved traumatogenic response would just come out, you know, unsolicited on several of the ladies. Mm. And it'd be like, "Whoa," you know.
They didn't even know it was going to happen, right?
God there were cameras in the room and witnesses in the room and a glass door, you know, had all these protections in place, obviously, because it was a women's penitentiary, so it have a little, multiple security things going on, especially if you're a man. You know, I'd actually hire female technicians to put the equipment on their heads and stuff, and with the gel and all that, so I wouldn't even have to touch these ladies. But anyhow, after seeing that, it's made me more of a proponent and a fan of interventions such as yours and EMDR techniques and some other things that we utilize. You know, occipital lobe activity. You know, from the back to the brain
and
activity.
It's funny. It's funny you should say that, because I did a year of credentialing in alpha theta with a guy named Bill Scott, who is kind of the premier alpha theta guy, and he taught me the scripts as well. And I decided that I wasn't going to use the scripts anymore, because you had some people that abreacted that way.
Right.
They would have emotional flooding.
Exactly.
And what we use now instead of that is we use a couple of different Tibetan Buddhist meditation techniques. One is called Tonglin. And Tonglin, what it does is it teaches the person and their subconscious how to connect with the pain of other people that are feeling the same pain. Because one of the biggest problems with trauma victims and newcomers too, by the way, is that they are incredibly isolated and cut off from other human beings. And it causes a lot of problems.
Hold on. Speaking of cut off, that's it. We're out of time here.
Oh, darn. So, okay. We're going to have to have David back again. See, David.
Yeah.
We. It's so interesting. We want to ask more questions. Yeah.
So, David, real quick, do you have a website or a phone number our listeners can get a hold of?
Yeah, we have two. For in local Southern California, LA, Orange County, and Riverside, it's Sleep Recovery Centers, CENTERS.com. It's all one word, no spaces. And we have some satellite offices. They're not real large. And then we're also doing home training. We actually have technicians come to people's homes, so it eliminates the traffic of them having to get to and from a clinic.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we are rolling out a national program that will allow us to be able to ship the equipment to people and run their sessions live right over the internet in their own home. And that website is sleeprecovery.care, C-A-R-E. And our toll-free number is area code 888-866-7378 or 888-866-REST, R-E-S-T.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming on today, David.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. I'm very grateful.
Have a great day.
All right. We'll see y'all here next week on the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Cindy DeFerdinand. We'll see y'all next week. Thanks for tuning in. Catch us on the podcast. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand only on LA Talk Radio.